Welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman.
I'm Stephanie. And we have a very special guest this afternoon on the Midday. She's won two Grammys, performed for Pope John Paul II, Hillary Clinton, the Supreme Court justices at the invitation of Sandra Day O'Connor.
So our guest is obviously none of those.
She's made, she's recorded 70 times, 70 CDs of recordings. And we're delighted to welcome soprano Sylvia McNair. She's opera singer, recitalist, and you also specialize in Broadway and jazz, and you've had an enormous career, and it's a real honor to have you here in the studio. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Sylvia McNair is here to appear this weekend with the Madison Symphony Orchestra. You'll be singing along with the orchestra, the chorus, the youth choir, and...
Actually, there's a total of four choirs on this concert.
Wow.
Two adult choirs, two children's choirs. Well, high school students probably don't appreciate being referred to as a children's choir. So let's say we have 2.5 adult choirs and one children's choir and a symphony orchestra that sounds fantastic, I hasten to add. So we're going to have a good time.
Glad to hear that. You're really marshaling the forces. talk about a backup.
Yeah, oh, I'm just there for decoration, really. No, it's John Demain that gets the credit for this one.
It takes, I'm not sure if this is really an apt metaphor, but it takes a power hitter, doesn't it, to hold sway with all those choruses, choirs?
Well, and John Demain is the power hitter. I mean, he's the glue that has to hold it all together. So, yeah, I hope he's sleeping well this week.
We'll all wish him well. Well, we have, with 70 CDs, not all of which we have, of course, we have a fairly...
You know, I have been making records for so long that many of them are out of print. So I'm not surprised to hear that you don't have all 70.
Did you actually make LPs? You're too young for that.
No, right? I will admit, my very first recording was with Robert Shaw and the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. We made the recording in February, I think it was February of 1982.
Oh, right at the very end.
It was released on LP. I have it. I own it. I don't have a way
have
to play
vinyl.
It, but I have the vinyl.
How does that work now if you get a golden record, if they even call them that? Is it a little gold CD now? Is that how that works? It'd be much less imposing.
Unfortunately, I don't have any idea. I'm sad to say.
We'll work on that. What did you perform on that first one with Robert
Shaw? The very first recording I ever made was the Poulenc Gloria with Mr. Shaw, his orchestra, and chorus. It was a fantastic experience. I was still a student at Indiana University. So for me to be going off with Robert Shaw singing concerts all over the country and making a recording, and I even got nominated for a Grammy my very first time out. But it was an LP. It was later released on CD, but I actually have a couple of things I did on wax.
Not the wax cylinder, I don't think.
That's what they mean.
Isn't vinyl kind of wax?
Yeah.
That's what they mean by waxing eloquent. That Poulenc Gloria, beautiful piece, though.
Yes.
And you were a student then. You teach now. You're on the faculty.
That's right.
Right.
I'm still a student, however, always a student. But yes, 25 years after I left Indiana University, I came back to join the faculty of the Jacobs School of Music at IU, and I'm teaching part-time and discovering that I'm learning much, much more than I'm teaching. I feel like Mrs. Anna.
I knew
in
you.
The
That's
King
exactly as you become a teacher by your students, you'll be taught.
Exactly. By my students, I am taught, and I have learned so much more from teaching than I ever dreamed possible. Teaching is actually the best teacher.
All
and
right.
Now I understand that concept.
So, not to be too mundane about it, but what are some of the things you learn from teaching as a great performer yourself?
Well, thank you. Around the Jacobs School of Music, especially in the voice department, I am known as the intonation diction Nazi because I really will not compromise on great intonation and clear diction. So when I'm pushing students all day long, or all afternoon at least, to raise their own standard, I, of course, in turn have to point all 9, 10 fingers back at myself. If I'm pointing one at them, all 9 fingers back at myself to make sure that my own work is of a higher and higher and higher level each time I open my mouth. That would be one thing. Oh my gosh, there are so many, you know, ways of presenting yourself on stage, whether you're speaking or singing. I run an audition techniques workshop, which has helped me analyze what I think is important about stage deportment, and therefore I try to do better myself. So many things, really.
Yeah, and there must be so many. I mean, this is the art, concealing art, though. I mean, you're supposed to make it look natural, everything you're doing on stage there, and yet it's all a matter of technique that has to be almost rendered second nature, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've heard it said, you know, the more natural it looks, the easier it looks, the harder the person is working on the inside. I'm not sure I agree with that entirely, but I try to make singing as natural and honest. That's one of my big words. Mm-hmm. Honest and organic, I guess, just to use a word that's way overused, as possible. I think gimmicks and tricks won't last. They look terrible. They sound terrible. Just tell the truth about who you are and use melody and good words to do that.
And the audience will always know. And they'll connect with it.
Yeah, I hope so. I think so. And you know, the great thing about being a singer is that each singer should sound different. I call it the vocal fingerprint. The individual sound of each person. No two singers
style
should sound alike. And, you know, when you turn on the radio and you hear a violinist playing the Mendelssohn E minor violin concerto, whatever, I can't always, in fact, let's be honest, I can't ever tell you exactly which violinist
it would be a tall order.
There are people who claim they can say that.
And they can tell you what instrument it is, too.
Well, but a violin,
I can tell you if it's a Stradivarius.
I see what you mean. Yeah. But when a singer is heard on the radio and you tune in the middle of a piece, let's say, each singer should sound unique. Each singer should have his or her own vocal fingerprint. So,
which they start with, but I suppose some of them unlearn how to sound unique.
That is one of the bad parts of teaching. Some teachers try to make students sound just like the teacher sounds. Yeah. I don't want to do that. And that's why I don't demonstrate a lot. I do some, but I'm afraid if I start demonstrating that students are going to try to copy me, and that's the last thing in the world I want them to do.
That's an interesting conundrum.
Why don't we see how the teacher sounds? What have you selected?
Well, we were talking a little bit about Mozart before we started here, and this is actually from, we have it. 1998 is when we got this recording of Sylvia McNair doing the Porgy Amor from The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart. Come now, you must really like that when you hear it.
I'm out of breath. was Neville thinking? It's so slow.
Well, we'll just have to get you to record it again sometime.
long, beautiful phrases.
Yeah, I mean, it is a gorgeous voice, and the simplicity, I think, that you mentioned is in there. I mean, it's a
miraculous piece. I will say that I never performed the role of the Countess in The Marriage of Figaro on stage. I only ever did the role of Susanna. Not only, that's the best role in the show, and I did about 15 productions of it in Europe and the United States. So I know that opera backwards and forwards, but when Philips Classics asked me to do a recording of Mozart arias, I asked permission to record some arias that I love but had never performed on stage, and they said, oh, of course. So that's why that's on that record.
Well, nice to have the backstory on there. Speaking of which, you had a, you have or had a radio career. What's
yes, the when I was in graduate school, I had about 4 part-time jobs just to hold everything together, and I was an announcer slash producer at the, I better not say the call letters because we're not in that state. I don't want to confuse anybody. WFIU, which was the NPR, is the NPR affiliate in Bloomington, Indiana, at Indiana University.
Good place for one. And this you played classical music, or did you sing live on the radio? Or
no,
what
I didn't sing, but I was, you know, I did news, I did music, I did chat shows and all kinds of things. I was young then. They always assigned me the Saturday morning sign on shift and the Sunday night sign off shift. So I was at the radio station at sort of 5 in the morning on Saturday mornings. I had no life, so it really didn't matter. But, and then I was there until 2 in the morning, Sunday, well, Sunday night, Monday morning. So it was, and for all of $8.50 an hour, I think.
Oh, yes.
So, no, less than that. That's the minimum wage now, isn't it? But,
well, you would, today, if you were to do that, you could play some of your own CDs. Add a little extra fun.
But I love radio. I absolutely love it. And, you know, I look good on the radio.
Well, you have a face both for radio and television and film.
Got all the parts.
Well, and speaking of the backstory, another aspect of things behind the scenes for you is that you've been a breast cancer survivor.
I am a breast cancer survivor, yes. I was diagnosed in the spring of 2006. And went through a really difficult year. I had 5 major cancer-related surgeries, body-altering surgeries. I was in chemotherapy for off and on for 29 months.
Wow!
In radiation for 2 months, and it was a dicey time. But I often say that cancer is one of the best things that's ever happened to me because it has changed the way I live very, very much for the better. I have a clarity that I did not have prior to cancer. I feel like I have a calm and a compassion for others that cancer heightened. So I wouldn't give it back. I wouldn't give it back for anything. It was tough, but I'm here and living very much more happily because of it.
What a marvelous outlook.
Do you think there was any connection between your ability to overcome that and the kind of perseverance that you need as a performer?
Maybe. It's interesting that you ask that because I do know that there were certain aspects in which I turned my cancer journey into a performance. And the fact that I'm comfortable being in front of people and I'm comfortable, you know, I've been in dressing rooms with designers, costume designers, guys and girls my entire life, you know, for me to take my clothes off in the doctor's office, I mean, it's just not an issue. And also, you know, when I lost all of my hair, I wasn't concerned about buying a wig that looked exactly like my hair so that no one would know I was bald. I went and bought peroxide blonde wigs, and I bought a pink wig and a bright green, lime green wig.
Take that ball and run with it.
And, you know, that aspect of it I did sort of try to have fun with. There isn't very much about cancer that's fun, so I tried to have fun with the few things that you can have fun with. I threw a lot of parties. I threw a huge dinner party the night before my first chemotherapy and served pink lemon drop martinis.
Pink being the color of breast cancer awareness.
Pink being the breast cancer color. I threw a party, a head shaving party. I threw, lots of dinner parties. The scarier it got, I just threw another party. It's kind of how I dealt with the scariness.
What a fascinating way to go about it.
Did it alter your voice in any way?
Many people have asked me that. My opinion, my feeling about it is that it did not. I will say that every time I went into the operating room knowing that I was going to be intubated, I was a wreck about that. And many anesthesiologists were so good to me, trying to find alternative ways to use anesthesia to so that they did not have to pass that tube down my vocal cords. And I remember after one of the surgeries, one of the first two or three surgeries, the next morning the anesthesiologist paid a visit to my hospital room. That doesn't ever happen. Anesthesiologists don't come see you in the hospital the next morning.
Did he ask you to sing a scale?
Well, he came into the room and he said, "Miss McNair, how are you?" And I spoke and my vocal cords were undamaged. And he breathed such a sigh of relief and then pulled out from behind his back three CDs that he had gone off to Borders or Barnes & Nobles to purchase after he left the hospital after my surgery.
Speaking of CDs, how about another selection?
All right, let's try something from I would say early music, but it's also kind of Baroque, kind of in the wash between, isn't it, Purcell?
17th century, that's right, early Baroque.
And this is If Music Be the Food of Love with our guest Sylvia McNair and the Academy of Ancient Music, Christopher Hogwood, conducting. If Music Be the Food of Love by Henry Purcell. We're celebrating this year the 350th anniversary of his birth. That was Sylvia McNair with the Academy of Ancient Music, Christopher Hogwood conducting. Sylvia, you're going to be singing, as we mentioned, with large forces all weekend. The performances start tomorrow night at 7:30 and then Saturday at 8, Sunday at 2:30. One right after the other, and these are pretty big performances. Does that get
taxing? There are a lot of people on the stage, that's for sure.
Is it taxing for you to do back-to-back?
As long as the repertoire is, one wouldn't do a Puccini opera three times in 3 days, but something like this, first of all, I love singing Christmas music in December. December is one of the best months of all 12 to be a singer, because doing Christmas music is so much fun. So I love doing this. I am just having the time of my life.
Have you ever recorded a Christmas CD in July or anything? You always wonder how people get into that.
You always have to record your Christmas CDs when it's 103 degrees outside.
Right, seems that way.
It's like doing
Dr. Zhivago
in
Spain.
That's just the way that works. And I do have one Christmas CD with my college concert choir, believe it or not, Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois. We did a Christmas CD last year, and we kind of made it all throughout the year, but I'm thinking about doing one next year, and we will indeed do it in June and July if we do it, which is a hard time to think about singing Frosty the Snowman.
Crank up the AC.
Exactly.
Our guest is soprano Sylvia McNair, who has had an extensive, successful career with so many recordings, starting from classical and working through Broadway and jazz. And what kind of program will you be doing this weekend?
This weekend's concerts are Christmas concerts, obviously, and we're doing everything from classical music to more popular music. The Madison Symphony Chorus will be opening the concert with the Haydn Te Deum. But then I'll be singing a beautiful sort of gospel Christian folk song, Christmas folk song, I guess you'd say, which is the beloved Mary, Did You Know? Many, many people love that song, including me. We will be joined by the younger children and the high school children's choirs doing beautiful songs. Somewhere in My Memory, Jesu Bambino, The Shepherd's Pipe Carol. The adult symphony chorus will then also be doing songs like A Spotless Rose. I'm singing a gorgeous arrangement of O Holy Night. So we have all kinds of stuff.
Really?
And then the second half of the concert is much more popular music. We Need a Little Christmas, that great Jerry Herman song that everyone knows and loves, Winter Wonderland. I'm singing I Requested to do a beautiful arrangement, which is not specifically Christmas, but I think of all the times of the year when I wish I could have this present, I love to sing a song called Let There Be Peace on Earth.
Oh, it's a classic.
Which is the greatest present that any of us could ever hope for and could ever receive at any time of the year. So it's and then, of course, the great fun thing is that at the end of the concerts, we have the audience join in for a sort of 8 or 10 minute medley of Christmas carols called A Holly Jolly Sing-Along.
And they even get the lyrics, don't they, in case they can't remember the second verse.
Well, and you can't remember all the verses to all these carols. So the words are printed in the programs, and everybody, the symphony and all four choirs and the soloist and John Demain and I will be singing along on the Holly Jolly Sing-Along.
And a few of those Santa Claus caps are bound to put in an appearance, I suspect.
You think?
Don't quote me, but I think so.
Now, your career has been very successful in so many different genres. When you're booked and traveling and singing, what is your predominant genre? What are you booked to sing?
Well, in 2002, I managed to log in 20 years of doing opera. I traveled, you know, nonstop, basically, for 20 years doing opera and all kinds of symphony orchestra concerts, classical music, predominantly classical music. In 2002, I decided, after 20 years on the opera stage, 20 was enough. 20 felt right. It was a nice round number. Many of those 20 years were on the best opera stages in the world. It was certainly 20 more years than I ever dreamed I would get. But I decided at 20 years to put all of the opera engagements into a beautiful box and tie a bow around it and place it up on a shelf and retire from the opera stage so that I could spend the next 20 or 30 years of my singing life doing musical theater productions. Musical theater has always been a love of mine, and frankly, I never had the time or the opportunity to do a lot of musical theater productions while I was so busy doing opera. And now I'm able to do that, and I am having the time of my life. I'm in the fun years. These are the fun years.
We asked not too long ago Thomas Hampson this question about singing so much opera, and then singing, in his case, something as simple as Stephen Foster, or in your case, you know, musical theater. Do you have to make a conscious effort not to oversing it?
I don't, because I feel like when I'm singing musical theater rep, or the Great American Songbook, as we sort of call it, I feel like I can sing with my own voice in the most natural way possible. Frankly, when I was doing opera, that's when I was having to manufacture a sound. I had to learn how to sing opera, and I did, and I was successful at it, loved most of it. But when I'm doing this kind of repertoire, the Great American Songbook, I feel like I'm using my own voice and living in my own skin as well as any kind of music.
And we're back to that concept of honest singing that you talked about at the beginning.
That's my goal.
We have something.
Yes, that we're going to accentuate.
And that would be the positive.
With our guest, Sylvia McNair.
Mess with Mr. In Between. With Mr. In Between. A doo 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 doo.
Cute song.
Accentuate the positive.
That Andre Previn can play the piano.
He sure can, and the double bassist was David Fink. And I have to say, this CD is called Come Rain or Come Shine, the Harold Arlen Songbook. And one of our classical hosts, Lori Skelton, gives this as a gift on a regular basis. It's one
so
of her favorites.
So just call in and she'll give you one.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
You have many, many fans in this building.
Thank you. That's very kind.
What are you discovering now? Musical discoveries.
Right this second.
Right this second,
I'm reading Scores to Settle, Stories of the Struggle to Create Great Music by none other than yourself, Norman Gilliland.
That was
And I just read something about Pablo Casals. That's what I'm discovering.
He was there's a very funny story about Pablo Casals. He's not a guy you wanted to cross, let's put it that way.
Back to Sylvia McNair, the critic Rex Reed talked about this style of singing for you, saw you at the Algonquin Hotel in the Oak Room and said, I could get used to this kind of ecstasy.
Well, you never print the bad reviews, that's the thing, right? So we only ever print the good ones. But that was an incredibly generous review from him.
Your career also includes a one-woman show. What is that all about?
I do a one-woman show, and I do it in cabaret venues in New York and Chicago, all over, actually, called Subject to Change, because life is, and I am, and my journey has certainly brought a lot of changes. Some of them were chosen by me. Some of them happened to me. But I talk about change and how we have to be ready to change. We have to be ready to reinvent ourselves if we want to survive. And you just try to have a sense of humor and go with it. Go with the flow.
Well, thinking about the music that you've helped us select today, with, you know, accentuate the positive and talking about Let There Be Peace on Earth, and it sounds like it's probably a very uplifting performance.
The Christmas concerts, mm-hmm. You mean? Well,
no, I'm talking about your one-woman show.
Well, thank you. I certainly hope it is. I have a huge set inside of that show where I highlight composers or musicians, let's say, that I call hybrids. Those of us who have a lot of classical music training and experience in our backgrounds, but have decided to do other things outside of the classical music neighborhood, I guess. People like Frank Lesser, who believed when he wrote Most Happy Fella that he was composing an opera. It's only ever performed in musical theater venues, really, and I love the show. I also highlight Leonard Bernstein, who lived very, very successfully in both the classical music world and Broadway. And, of course, Andre Previn, who there just doesn't seem to be any limit to that man's skill and gift. He is one of the greatest pianists, both jazz pianists and classical pianists, that I've ever heard. And, of course, he's a composer and a conductor. So, Kurt Weill, that's another one. I have sung a show recently of all Kurt Weill
songs. Wonderful, smoky stuff.
Very dark, too. Very, very
clever lyrics,
emotionally
in many cases,
taxing. I'm in the middle of doing a production of a show called Songspiel, 19 songs by Kurt Weill. We're doing it in Baltimore and Washington, D.C. And he was a composer who was trained classically, but then reinvented himself extremely successfully when he came to New York, when he came to America in the 30s. So in any case, my show is, and I consider myself to be a hybrid. I am definitely a hybrid. Decades of violin and piano studies as well as singing. And now I'm sort of in a different neighborhood than the classical music world and having a great time.
I saw that you had actually started as a violin student.
That's right.
And
that's
right. They heard you
and
sing.
I still play violin. I practice every day, or try to, and play my violin. I love it. And I, when I'm singing, when I'm doing my best singing, I am just simply trying to sing like the best instrumentalist that I can be.
Well, speaking of instrumentalists, we're going to hear in just a moment you sing something that has no words. And this is exactly what she's doing in this famous piece by Rachmaninoff. Are there any particular trick to coming into a piece like this?
You know, my mind is still so tangled up trying to work out this device question, playback device question.
All will be revealed in 14 minutes.
Well, the Rachmaninoff Vocalise is one of the most beloved, famous pieces in the world. You know, it was tricky for me to record this piece, to perform it. I've performed it often, but I am such a words-first person. I'm such a words-first singer. I tell students all the time, words first, music second. I love to approach a song from the position of text first. And so this was tricky for me, but, you know, I drew on my violin days and tried to blend into the orchestra. And I don't know. We'll see how it turned out.
Our guest, Sylvia McNair, with the Vocalese of Rachmaninoff, featuring also the Baltimore Symphony with David Zinman conducting. Does that, I know you were casting all kinds of aspersions on it, Sylvia, but does that end there really require extra special discipline to do that long trailing finale there?
I don't know. I don't know what to say. That piece is too high and too long.
Oh, it's beautiful. It was melting, just gorgeous. The Vocalese by Rachmaninoff. That was the Baltimore Symphony with David Zinman conducting.
And for now, for the balance of this hour, we have Sylvia McNair with us.
She's here in Wisconsin, appearing with the Madison Symphony Orchestra, the Madison Chorus, the Madison Youth Choirs, the Mount Zion Gospel Choir, all for the Christmas Spectacular this weekend, Friday night, Saturday night, and then there's a Sunday matinee. And you can find more information at madisonsymphony.org or sylviamcnair.com. Or you can call the ticket office at the Overture Center, which is 608-258-4141.
I'm just curious, Sylvia, you mentioned earlier your conscious transition from opera after 20 years into other kinds of music. Did you have like a farewell tour, or did you just slide into it unannounced?
I just slid into oblivion without very much fanfare, really. It was time. It was just time. I did not do a big Oprah Winfrey announcement that I was ending my opera career. I just did a Britten opera, beautiful piece called The Midsummer Night's Dream, Shakespeare, really. And then I said, that's it. That's enough now.
And then
I'm going to do other things.
And speaking of other things, we're going to hear something that's a little different than the Vocalese.
We are. But before I front announce that, Stephanie, I want to say hi to Susie and Jim Miller from Indiana University. Woohoo!
There must be some more of those out there, too. Hoosiers, I guess they would be, right?
It's a great school. It's a great school of music, and we all stick close together. We are going to now hear, for the very last song of this hour, a fabulous tune from the Harold Arlen songbook disc that I did with Andre Previn about 10 years ago, a little over. This is Words by Truman Capote, music by Harold Arlen. This is a great song for a gray, snowy day in Wisconsin. This is called Two Ladies in the Shade of a Banana Tree.
You've got the job.
Pause. The main reason and cause, two ladies in the shade of the banana tree, how delectable, desirous they can be, in the black, black shade of the banana tree. With lips pouting to please and eyes rolling to tease, the most popular plan designed to capture man, two ladies in the shade of the banana tree.